people like to talk, but they don't understand all the reasons for relationship between a woman or a man. They talk about it, but they really don't know all of the qualities that makes a love grow. They're green with envy, speculate and hate. Negative thoughts don't control my fate. You know it might not be right for the world. Oh no,
might not be right.
Oh no, you know it might not be right for the world.
Good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It's a big show today. We have a lot going on and a lot to talk about, so we will get right to it and welcome you. You can be a part of the conversation simply by joining us, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear what you have to say, panel at WAMC.org. Just a quick... an event reminder that tonight we are going to be at Skidmore College, and I'll be talking to famed environmentalist Bill McKibben, who has written a new book out called Here Comes the Sun, which looks at the subtitle, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. I think that will give you an idea of where the talk will be headed. We are at the Gannett Auditorium in Skidmore College at Palo Mountain Hall. Now, here's the deal. The event is sold out, but if you go to Northshire.com, there is a wait list there, and you can get on the wait list. But it is Northshire.com, and find out more. Bill McKibben, our good friend, tonight at 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock. Earlier than I thought. Okay, 6 o'clock. Probably good that I looked at that. Wednesday, tonight, 6 o'clock at the Gannett Auditorium, Northshire.com. Okay, other stuff. Let me introduce our wonderful panel. By the way, hell of a show today. I just want to say, not only do we have this incredible panel, but coming up, we're going to talk, in our 11 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to Dan Brown. Dan Brown wrote The Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code took place primarily, well, in the beginning, in the Louvre. Mm-hmm. And it starts off with a dead curator. Well, Dan Brown spent years at the Louvre and investigating the Louvre, so we thought it would be interesting to talk to him about what's going on at the Louvre, and we'll talk to Dan Brown coming up. Also, ecologist, botanist, and Native American scholar Robin Wall Kimmerer, best known for braiding sweetgrass in the serviceberry, will join us and tell us about her new book for children, and we will round things out by talking to former White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, who is now an independent and All right.
Joe, did you ask Dan where he was last Sunday morning around 9:30?
he said he was in New Hampshire. Yeah, a likely story indeed.
Does it sound like a Monty Python skit though? A dead curator in the Louvre?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then this thing is just bizarre. Yeah. And well, anyway,
and they were uninsured.
And it just creeps on. Let me introduce the group to you. They're ready to go. We have a lot to discuss. Founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics, Humanities, and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz is here. Roger was a wonderful host of an event that we had last Friday at the conference for the center that took place on Thursday and Friday. We were there for the Friday edition. We had an amazing time, and it was an incredible group and an incredible conference, and it's wonderful to see you again, and it's also, I congratulate you on putting on such an amazing event.
Well, thank you very much, and it was really a pleasure to have you at the conference.
We didn't eat, too many snacks.
No. Okay. Come again, eat more.
It's often the complaint, Bob, you know. Bob Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Hello, Bob Griffin.
Hi, everybody. Even on a sort of gray, fall, wet day, today it's apropos. I saw that today is National Nut Day, and considering I thought that the country was nuts, that it was a celebration for all of us. Then I read the description, and it's about almonds and walnuts. So you know,
peanuts.
Peanuts too. So pine nuts. We could have a nut theme today, which would celebrate both the day and where I think the country is.
Very nice. Good how you packaged all that together.
I'm done. Mic drop.
Retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jocknowitz. Hello. How are you?
I'm well. And as my mom used to say in a whole other context, every day is nut day.
Why isn't there a Children's Day?
Yeah. Oh, there you go. There you go. That's good. Former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, joins us. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for having me back.
It is always a pleasure to have you on the program. About 10 minutes ago, Bob asked me a question about where we were going to start this morning. And as I was putting my response together, we started the show. And so, Bob, we're going to start with Trump asking for $230 million.
Oh.
Okay. All right.
Following the theme of Nut Day.
So here we go. President Trump is demanding that the Justice Department pay him $230 million in compensation for the federal investigations into him, according to people familiar with the matter, who added that any settlement might ultimately be approved by senior department officials who defended him or those in his orbit. The situation has no parallel in American history. How many times have we gotten to say that over the last couple of years? Mr. Trump, a presidential candidate, was pursued by federal law enforcement and eventually won the election. I do think it's important. This is what I was saying to my screaming at my radio last night as I heard this story coming home. You won! You won! Anyway, the situation has no parallel. It's the starkest example yet of potential ethical conflicts created by installing the president's former lawyers atop of the Justice Department. Mr. Trump submitted complaints through an administrative claim process that often is the precursor of lawsuits. The first claim, lodged in late 2023, seeks damages for a number of purported violations of his rights, including the FBI and special counsel investigation into Russian election tampering and possible connections to the 2016 Trump campaign, according to people familiar with the matter. They spoke on the condition of anonymity because the claim has not been made public. This all from a New York Times report that I am reading this morning by Devlin Barrett and Tyler Pager. Asked about the issue at the White House after an article published, the president said, "I was damaged very greatly, and any money I would get, I would give to charity."
Mm-hmm.
"I'm the one that makes the decision, and that decision would have to go across my desk, and it's awfully strange to make a decision where I'm paying myself." You think? Lawyers said the nature of the president's legal claim poses undeniable ethics challenges. Bennett Gershman is an ethics professor at Pace University. He took all of this information in. He looked at all of the paperwork in front of him.
And the quote of the day?
"What a travesty," is what he said. "The ethical conflict is just so basic and fundamental, you don't need a law professor to figure this one out." All right, so we begin. Judy Patrick.
Breathtakingly unethical, I would say. And, you know, the bottom line here is it's going to happen no matter what. There's nothing anybody can do about it. And I love the idea that even Donald Trump thinks that, you know, this seems odd to him. If you remember, in many ways, the prosecutions ginned up his campaigns, helped him, if nothing else. And also, he didn't pay his own legal fees. He had committees pay his legal fees, so he wasn't really out any money. If anything, I think he gained from the prosecution. So maybe he should be paying us back. At a time, I would think the Democrats have their fingers crossed, hoping he actually gets paid, because isn't that a wonderful political campaign argument. So nothing you can do. It's a bit of a distraction at this point, but I don't think he really was damaged in any way by these things.
$230 million and said to be going to charity, which and I don't think I'm just saying something that's been proven and reported, which is that the Trump and the Trump brand and their relationship of giving money to charity is quite questionable and has been questioned over many, many years, well before he even entered the political realm. Roger Berkowitz.
You know, I mean, there's an absurdity to this, and yet, as Judy said, Trump recognizes the absurdity. I mean, I agree, and I thought the prosecutions were a mistake because I thought they would help Trump. You know, there's no doubt that being prosecuted by four or five different prosecutors around the country, having your homes invaded, and such, is something that will upset people. And there was, I think, you know, I look, he a lot of these things that he was prosecuted for, he did, and so these were discretionary prosecutions. I thought at the time, and I still think that it was wrong to do them, and I can understand why he has a grievance. And I think we have to understand that he and many people in his orbit do feel that the federal government singled him out and was weaponized against him. And I don't think that's entirely wrong. I think at this point, what he's asking for is ridiculous, and the idea that his loyal minions are going to just give it to him is a joke. And, you know, I agree with Joe that he's not a very charitable person. That's been shown over and over again, but we'll see. I think it's a distraction, but I think it's evidence of just a deeper and deeper sense of corruption on which both sides have no trust in the impartiality or goodness or truthfulness of the institutions of our country. And I think it's a travesty, but it's where we're at.
The president seemed to acknowledge that this was odd in the Oval Office last week when he alluded vaguely to the situation while standing next to the FBI director, Kash Patel, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and her deputy, Todd Blanche. According to Justice Department regulations, the deputy attorney general, in this case, Mr. Blanche, is one of two people eligible to sign off on the settlement. Trump said, quote, "I have a lawsuit that was doing very well, and when I became president, I said, well, I'm sort of suing myself," adding, "it sort of looks bad. I'm suing myself, right? So I don't know, but that was a lawsuit that was very, very strong, very, very powerful." Bob Griffin.
Oh, God, where do I start? You know, even though it's absurd and he will publicly recognize, he being Trump will publicly recognize the oddity of it, it's not going to stop him. I have a personal theory, though, that this is part of a plan that he has, that as he looks at his lists of his Festivus poll of grievances against the country and against the citizens of the country, that this is on it, and he's going to push forward to try to take every cent possible out of the public treasury. And I think, Judy, I thought you were going down a path that I want to take a couple steps down. Is that at the same time he's talking about the $230 million robbery, the state of Texas, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, New York, and several other states are warning its recipients that there will be either a reduction or complete elimination of SNAP benefits. Okay, let's start to frame where this guy is. Okay, at the same time, the government is shut down, and you're seeing federal workers and their families literally in line for basic necessities like food. This administration is spending $178 million to purchase two luxury jets for the Secretary of Homeland Security. At the same time, women, the WIC program, Women Infant Care Program, which is designed specifically to deal with the most vulnerable of populations, is being decimated. They're ripping down the White House to build a ballroom. We're talking about a government that is.
I believe it's a wedding venue. But go ahead.
Is he getting married again?
No, I think they're going to rent it out.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now I get it. I just figured he was due. You know, it's stunning to me that the brazenness of it and the fact that there's still such a large proportion of the country that supports him. Roger, I understand the comment, and I do go back and forth on this idea, and part of me agrees with Romney's assessment that Biden should have just pardoned Trump as part of the presidency, cleared the deck, sort of similar how Ford did. But at the same time, the findings in these reports were upheld. And what's interesting to me is that the issue of Russia and Russia collusion was actually upheld in a report that came out of the Senate that was published by none other than our current Secretary of State Rubio. My continued and consistent frustration, and one of the reasons why I have dramatically soured on both Biden's presidency, but more importantly on Merrick Garland, is I don't think that he moved quickly enough. So I'm not surprised by this. I also will toss out for the panel to talk about is this also shows you the dysfunction and basic fecklessness of Congress. Okay, they control the purse strings. Okay, yeah. There is no oversight right now, and that's a real problem for the country.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we want to get to Jay and hear his thoughts on this. We welcome your thoughts as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this news from the BBC.
Love is taking our sweet time, wishing nothing away.
Ruthie Foster is the music we're listening to, playing Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs, New York, tomorrow. That's Thursday the 23rd. You can see the complete playlist of the songs we play into our panel segments by going to WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. And again, Ruthie Foster playing Cafe Lena in Saratoga on the 23rd. All right, back to our discussion about the $230 million that Donald Trump now wants as a result of being put through the process that he was put through. Jay Jockowitz.
There's just so much to unpack there. To Bob's point that, all this other stuff is going on, that people who are on SNAP benefits are facing going hungry, that people who have health coverage are going to lose their health coverage because they won't be able to afford it, that all the rest of us, anyone who's buying anything from just about anywhere else in the world other than rather rare these days, made entirely in America products, is paying an extra tax on it because of this president. Just on and on, that there are all these financial issues facing the country, and here the president wants $230 million. Wants a $230 million refund, as Judy pointed out, of something he didn't even pay in the first place. He raised this money from all the people out there, many of whom have since complained that they were put on lists that they didn't intend to be on, that, you know, recurring payments from their credit cards until they discovered it. It's just grifting, just so much of it. But I think and the obviousness of this, as the person pointed out, you don't need a law professor to explain the ethical problem here. It's extraordinary. And as the Times pointed out, the maybe one person who might be able to referee this, the ethics of it, has been fired by the same president who now finds himself in this self-made ethical dilemma. But I think the really, really important thing to remember is has been touched on to some degree is that None of this, except the Russia investigation, has been really adjudicated. My editors always reminded me there is no such thing as pleading innocent or being found innocent. You're found not guilty. And Trump has not even been found not guilty. Certainly, he's never going to be found innocent of anything, I don't think. But the documents case, it is not a parallel, as much as he and many of his defenders want to make it. It is not a parallel to Biden. He took pains to cover up what he should have just given back, and it could have all gone away. And that's why the Justice Department did a raid on his house, was because he was just digging in and saying, I don't have the documents, and daring them to come and take them. The January 6th case was not adjudicated, and Georgia was not adjudicated. The obstruction, the Russia one, is really interesting because he wants to maintain, and Bill Barr gave him some cover on this, he wants to maintain that he didn't do anything wrong, when in fact as a plain reading of the findings showed, he obstructed and obstructed and obstructed, and his administration obstructed. This should be, he's bringing up he's acting as if he was found completely innocent of all these things, completely not guilty of all this, when in fact, either he was guilty of some of it or it's never been fully hashed out. And the government should not be in the business of giving a refund on that basis.
But, Joe, it's not a bad strategy if you think about it in terms of by raising sort of these examples of when he was supposedly mistreated and bringing the attention of his base back, he's taking attention away from how bad the economy is. Mm-hmm. And for any of you who are out there who have gone food shopping lately, you know the prices haven't come down. If any of you follow any of the trade magazines, you know that the holidays are going to be grim. When you think about the issues of the federal shutdown, what that's doing to the overall economy, and sort of the whole malaise that I feel is all around us with the economy, taking attention back and taking attention from those real issues and saying, I've just been treated so badly, you can't believe anything any of them say, may not be the worst strategy. Hmm. I also wouldn't be at all surprised. Let me toss this little nugget out for, I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't continue to make these wild grabs for personal aggrandizement, personal, money for him and his family, because he knows that he's not going to last his term out, and that he'll step back, get a full pardon from Vance, and then he will have achieved everything that he's looking for.
Can we also talk a little bit about the lack of transparency in this whole endeavor? When they do finally make a settlement, there's no requirement that they make this public. These kinds of settlements happen in the dark. Public does not know about it. One other point, price of eggs is down in the 250 range. Wahoo, that's good. But the price of orange juice is through the roof, over $5 for a gallon. That's my grocery report for you.
It is worth noting, he made these claims in 2023, if I'm not mm-hmm. mistaken.
Yes.
I mean, this is not something that he's doing now, either to gain attention or for other reasons. He made them because he thought he was mistreated. Whether you agree with that or not, I think in part he was. But I think the issue now is that he has appointed second-rate, third-rate, fourth-rate talents to lead the FBI, the Justice Department, and other departments in his government, who are basically full-on loyalists and are going to do his bidding. And this is the problem, and it goes back to the lack of oversight throughout the entire government, not only in his administration but in Congress, as Bob was talking about. There's a level of tyranny wannabe tyrant tyranny or tyranny going on, in which he has basically extinguished all the opposition. To me, that's the issue. You know, whether he gets his $230 million and gives it to charity or not, you know, I think it's disgusting. I think there's a level of corruption. He just made $5 billion, you know, on cryptocurrency investments that would not have been possible without him being president. And he's made tons of other recent, you know, money. The level of corruption in this administration is astronomical. But the real challenge and the real disgusting part is just the fact that he sees no he sees the problem with the conflict of interest. Everyone sees it, but he doesn't care. He's normalized full-on corruption in the government. And that's the issue that I think, at least for me, we need to focus on.
We have a couple of letters from listeners on this subject that I would like to get to. Rhonda says, who actually issues and signs checks or withholds them without congressional approval? Well, this has been an issue, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, like, if I understand correctly, there's three or four people within the Department of Justice, and I think Todd Blanchard is one of them. And Judy was right that there are pots of money. Without getting too far into the intricacies of the federal government, there are. We always call it different colors of money. You know, some money was only you could only have it for a year. Some you could have for 3 years, and then there are pots of money that were evergreen that were there to pay out on debts and legal obligations that the government would have, and that would be coming out of this pool. Judy also, I think, put her thumb on something that I think is incredibly aggravating, and that's the lack of transparency about payoffs and why taxpayers' dollars are going to pay off. And this isn't just an issue for Trump and the presidency. This is an issue for Congress as well. So when members of Congress get in trouble and they're held accountable and then we, the taxpayers, are paying for their misdeeds, we never are told what those misdeeds are, and therefore they are continued to allow to do the bad behaviors that they are. So this is wrapped into a much broader problem.
Okay. I just have a question for Bob and Judy on this then. I mean, we talk about the rule of law. We want to defend the rule of law. We want to defend transparency. You know, my friend Ivan Krastev over in Europe, who's been studying illiberal governments and the return of liberal governments after they've been voted out and then liberal governments come back in, has said that liberals or whatever you want to call it, moderates, get caught in this bind where they call for the rule of law. But then you have all these laws that have been made, civil servants that have been appointed, judges that have been appointed by illiberal regimes, and you're caught. You have to use them and you can't get rid of them, and you want to try and, you know, reform the government and bring it back, and yet do you use illiberal means to do it? And I guess I do worry that you know, after 4 years of Trump, maybe I don't know how many, you know, or whatever, you know, many of the positions of power in this country and the federal government are going to be his appointees. Are we going to say rule of law means we can't fire them, we can't get rid of them, or are we going to clean house? And I think you put yourself in a kind of straitjacket, and I don't know how you guys think about that, but I think looking down the road, the continued talk about rule of law, transparency, et cetera, is going to come back to bite us if we actually want to try and govern in a post-Trumpian world.
Judy, you want to say, or you want me to?
Well, there's a lot of talk about rule of law and precedent and past, you know, and norms. And we hear this from Mike Johnson and people in the Republican part, House, who say, well, the precedent, past practices, you don't swear someone in until the House is in session. Well, that's just past practice. That's not a law. So I think you can't give up the approach of rule of law, but it's more than just the rules of law. It's past practice. It's norms. Will someone, I mean, that was the hope when Biden came into office, that he was going to bring us back from, you know, the edge. And And part of the, you know, part of the reason we're in this bind with the Donald Trump settlement is that Merrick Garland's Justice Department, he could have dismissed one of those Trump's claims at least before he left office. But he was probably trying to do the right thing and thinking, well, this was not the right approach for him to take. And here we are sitting with this. I think you're seeing a little bit of the pushback from the Democrats at this point where they're fighting back on the redistricting plans. They, you know, technically, they like to do it every 10 years and do it in a fair and measured way. I mean, not always. I agree. But now they're going, nope, we're going to, like Gavin Newsom, we're going to go into California and we're going to redistrict tit for tat. Well, I don't know, Bob, would you add to that?
Yeah, no, I think this is going to be one of the biggest challenges. Say there's a change in administration through an election process. My thoughts are the administration is going to need to go in and be hyper-aggressive in putting its people in place. In ways that it typically didn't. And I thought Biden was really slow in putting people in place and removing Trump, the Trump appointees, which is the right of the administration. I'm talking particularly at the senior executive level. The federal government, right, is going to be decimated. And we really don't talk about what's happened with the career civil service. There's going to have to be a planning process that goes back and actually tries to woo back people to the government and government service. We've lost so many, you know, decades of experience, people that we're going to need to be able to bring back in order to start to restore some of this. The stable's going to have to be cleaned, though. And make no doubt about it that part of what Russ Voigt and the Heritage Foundation intendedly is doing is making it impossible for the Democrats to have the apparatus in place to implement their policy. So even if they win, okay, everything is going to be so broken that they're not going to be able to implement it.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a letter or two, and then we'll move on to other subjects. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break. And you are the road when times get bad. You're good for my soul. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are talking about Donald Trump and basically giving the American people a $230 million bill.
Yeah.
Here is Dave's thoughts. Everyone in the media tries to make moderate statements about extreme behavior. This isn't an ethically challenged issue. The man is the most corrupt person in American history by orders of magnitude. The Republican Party and backs him unquestionably as utterly crooked and corrupt in doing so. Once upon a time, they used to say, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. And now their party cult leader is a convicted felon. The only president to be so in American history. He's taking once the Middle Eastern country gave him $2 billion into his crooked cryptocurrency scams, and these are just among his greatest hits. Excuse me. The list is endless. Either something is done about him regarding this and so many other issues, or America is over.
Yeah, I have to agree that it's not just corruption that's the issue here. It's kind of this, you know, I think it's telling that he said, I'm sort of suing myself. It's weird. It reminds me of Louis XIV saying, you know, what was it? L'état, c'est moi. Yeah. I am the state. I am the government. And the Supreme Court, to some degree, has been saying, yeah, kind of you are. You're the executive branch. You're in charge of everything. You can't have Congress creating these. Some of these cases are still being winding their way through the system, but they're basically saying Congress can't even set up independent agencies to, you know, that are beyond the president's reach. He can fire whoever he wants and so forth. So it is this idea that do we have a king or do we have a president who's subject to rules?
The one thing that strikes me, though, and at the risk of angering some, nothing is being done here that he did not tell the American people while he was running for president for this second term that he hasn't done. Yeah. I mean, it's not like none of this is a secret. I think a couple of you said, you know, yes, it's a diversion, but it's not a surprise. Every single thing he's not. I mean, he's shown all the cards, mm-hmm. and he won. And he's still complaining. Yeah. I mean, I just find that like that's fascinating to me. But he said, if I win, I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this and this and this.
But doesn't it show the weakness, the inherent weakness in the messaging out of the Democratic Party right now? Oh. I mean, let's be honest. The fact that you can't message against this guy and be picking up 80% of the population to me is dumbfounding.
Well, the other thing, too, is that I think sometimes, I mean, you can make the argument, and I've heard this argument made, that, well, you can't believe a politician, they're just going to say all this stuff, and, oh, that's just Trump being Trump. Well, no, I mean, we had a first administration that certainly gave us every indication that he was going to do exactly what he said he was going to do in the second administration.
I keep on my, in the office at the paper, I keep the, one of the last two editorial sections that we did before the election, and the headline across the top, and it was a full page editorial. It said, "Donald Trump is unfit," and it listed all the reasons, and it listed everything, you know, all the highlights of this, the corruption, the bigotry, the dishonesty, the serial lying, the incompetence, everything. And you're right, and he got elected, but that doesn't mean, as many people that I listen to on the right seem to think, that it gives him the right to just fulfill every corrupt desire.
No, not at all. But again, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. And a majority. I always get in trouble when I say this, but
go ahead.
I mean, more people voted for him.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Yeah. And so they approve it in that sense. So I don't know.
You know, the letter writer began by saying the media is not doing enough to focus on this. So I thought
that would get you.
It continues to be a real debate in journalistic circles, because is it okay just to put a passing reference, this is highly so unethical that you don't need a law professor to tell you? Mm. Or do you put that higher in the story? Or do you write whole stories about this? Or do you write whole series about what ethics means, or what is true and what is not true? It is for the media, we're worried about losing the trust of our readers. And the thought is, if you focus too heavily on all the unethical, all the wrong, all the illegal things happening, that you're going to churn your readers away and you're going to lose them entirely. So it's a real issue.
Well, I mean, don't you feel that way too? I mean, we're all in this in a sense of a journalistic sense, and it you know, you look down, you see on your phone, oh well, today there's a. and I mean, you know, it's hard.
It's exhausting.
It's exhausting, and you don't know exactly what to do and what to think of it, because it's not going to stop, and it's just going to keep going on.
He got elected, and he got elected. We all knew he was corrupt after the first term, mm-hmm. and it's not like, I mean, I hate to say it to the letter writer, but it's not like people aren't writing about the fact that he's corrupt. I mean, it's in the front page of the newspaper half
every
the days.
Day, right?
He admits it. Right. He admits it. He likes it. He's celebrating it. The real problem here, and Bob, I think, put his foot in it, is the Democrats have a toxic brand. We have to understand why people across this country don't care about Trump's corruption. And the answer is they think the whole system is wildly corrupt. Right. They think that a large group of people who are largely educated and wealthy have basically taken over the country and run the country for their benefit to the exclusion of everyone else. Is that true? We can get into the arguments, right? But that's what they think. And the Democrats have lost any ability to speak to people outside of a very small, shrinking group of educated elites in urban centers. They have no ability to speak to people outside of these urban centers. And that's where a large part of the country lives. And until the Democrats are able to articulate and it's policy, but it's also trust. until the Democrats are able to say you should trust us and you shouldn't resent us, the resentment against the ruling elite, which is no longer ruling but is still seen as an elite in this country, is so intense and so toxic that Trump can get up there and say, oh, yeah, I'm corrupt, but they're corrupt. And so, you know, at least I'll break their system and I'll break them. And that's what people want.
I think he poses a unique challenge, though, to anybody that wants to oppose him. And of all things, I was listening to talk radio, right wing talk radio on the way in, and the host made a really good point. He said if it was just one or two things, the Democrats would have something to focus on. But from day to day to day, they don't know even what to do about him. And in a sense, that's true. The other point is that the Democrats have no effective power except what they're demonstrating now with the shutdown. And that'll be interesting to see. I mean, this is their chance to message like never before. This may be the only chance they get to message really well in this administration. And it'll be interesting to see who wins that battle. This may be their chance to come back. And the other thing is that and I lost track of it. And my scribble doesn't help me. a really excellent piece was written, and I think it got to that theory of everything. What is it about this guy that so much of America just does not even care about the corruption? It was a piece that just kept going back to the phrase "He's your man." It was every base instinct in people. He has found a way to appeal to that, and so even if you don't like one thing, he appeals to you on some other level that is corrupt and that you might want to see in a politician. So he's your man if you're, you know, if you're afraid of minorities. He's your man if you're if you think the government is they're all corrupt. So why not put someone the most corrupt ever in charge? And it was just on and on and on and on. It was a beautiful, beautifully written piece. I think it was. I want to say it was Fenton O'Toole because he does stuff like that, but I don't think it was. I don't think the Democrats know what to do with him was probably the biggest takeaway of all that.
We'll get back to this. We're going to take a break when we return. I just saw Bernie Sanders was on The Daily Show on Monday. And first of all, the guy comes out and the whole audience just like explodes. But of the people who spoke at the No Kings rally in D.C., I mean, he's the featured speaker. He is, and that's great. All I'm saying is, like, right now he's the guy. You know, he's the only. I mean, AOC, yes, but as far as people who are like the marquee speakers to go out and to fight and to talk about these issues, that's it.
Where's the future?
We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Some days I'm running on fumes. I fill my cup up just to pour.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 22nd of October. It is 9 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. A delight to have you with us, and I thank you so much. We have wonderful panelists, and they are in alphabetical order. Roger Berkowitz, founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities, and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. Bob Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Jay Jochnowitz, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union, and former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Roger, fresh from a conference on joy, which brings us to Brian's letter. It's sad to say, but all is lost already. The king had complete control because of the cowards in the Republican Party and the ignorance of the American electorate. I believe that any future elections are not going to happen. I just hope I am wrong. Bob, you wanted to talk about this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hope you're wrong, too. I can tell you that special shout out to everybody who stood out in the beautiful weather on Western Avenue across the country on Saturday. It's probably one of the most American things that we could do is to question and protest our government. I think it's part of what makes this country great. But it's also the worst thing that we can do collectively is to throw up our hands and say all is lost. That you have to continue to push. We have an election coming up in a week and a half, beginning of November.
Yeah.
And even if you aren't paying attention to who's running at the local elections, I'll tell you the best thing you can do is show up and vote, because the numbers send a clear message to politicians. So if you think, well, what can I do? Show up and vote at the election. There are a couple of elections, though, that I'm paying particular attention to, and I think it goes back to the issue of messaging. The governor's race in Virginia, the governor's race in New Jersey, I think are incredibly important, and I think they're bellwethers into how the parties are being perceived and how the populace are viewing both the current conditions, but also where they think future hope is. So pay attention to what's going on in both New Jersey and Virginia. Virginia is one that I'm paying particularly close attention to, because in my mind, when I look at the differences in the capabilities and platforms of the two candidates, it to me should be a runaway election for the Democratic nominee. And the polling that I saw as recently as yesterday has it down in single digits.
I think the New York City race is going to be an interesting one, just in terms of the Democratic Party itself. I mean, you got a very institutional candidate in Andrew Cuomo, and you've got a very progressive candidate in Mondami, and you know how that turns out is going to be interesting. I was astounded, by the way, it's a little off topic, but I was just astounded that Cuomo's latest attack on Mondami is to say he's Bill de Blasio. He's a mini Bill de Blasio, a person that Andrew Cuomo rendered ineffective in large part because of the battles that he had with him, the ego battles that he had. So anyway, but it is an interesting kind of soul of the Democratic Party fight.
Craig writes, perhaps you all have forgotten how many Republicans lost to Trump before the Democrats did. The media has pointed out every day Trump's flaws. It's not a Democratic messaging problem. The fact is, Trump normalizes our worst flaws on ourselves, and it turns out people like that. Then we go to Melanie.
I'm sorry. I really don't understand what I mean. So in his first election, he was able to
do. I think he means the Rhino Republicans. I mean, although I don't know, but that's what I assumed he means.
All the Republicans he beat in the primaries,
right?
Yeah,
but the Republican Party has been completely consumed by MAGA and Donald Trump. I don't think it actually exists as a viable party right now on its own. So, the only counterbalance that I can see is from the Democratic Party. Hmm.
We go to Melanie, who says, I don't understand why the letter isn't. There we go. Maybe? Matthew says, the Democrats could focus on fundamental corruption that underpins it all, but they do not, because they would have to hold themselves to the same standard, and that would hurt the dominant forces behind Democratic Party leadership. That from Matthew. Also, back to Melanie.
I generally agree with that. I think part of the problem right now is that there are interests, power interests, in not only the Democratic Party, but in sort of what I would call the left and right center forces of our government that don't want to actually address fundamental inequalities and imbalances and corruptions over the last 20 and 30 years that have led to this problem. And I think Matthew's right.
Andrew writes to us and says, when are we going to focus on the actual problem, the lack of education and critical thinking skills of the American population as a whole? That's why we are here. Sorry for the unpolitically correct viewpoint. Then we check in with Dave. I am not, nor will I ever be, a Trump fan or an apologist. That said, The opposition needs to stop taking the bait whenever he says or does something outrageous. It is designed to take our eyes off the ball, just like a magician uses distraction to perform. We have to focus on real issues that actually impact the lower and middle classes, housing, healthcare, affordability, to name a few.
Yeah, and I would add on to that the misuse of the military and the concern about, I mean, my growing concern about our involvement in a war against Venezuela. There are, I think, really important and key talking points that the Democratic Party should and could be putting out, and they're not. But I think fundamentally, getting back to a bread and butter issue about affordability, cost of living, and that includes healthcare, it includes housing, it includes food, and it's going to include warmth. And when we start to stare down potential for a bad winter.
You know, I know plenty of smart people who are Trump supporters. Let's not. Yeah. One of the Democrats' problem is they like to broad-based paint Trump supporters as stupid and uneducated. I think that is a basic problem. The other problem Democrats are having is they're boring. They're uninteresting. Trump is really interesting to watch. I think it's not so much the substance, it's the style in which they deliver their message. They need to really, they are so worried about making a mistake, about saying the wrong thing, that they become stilted. They become unalterably uninteresting. And I think that's one of the reasons, I mean, Sanders is interesting. Mandami is interesting. The efforts for them to try, like with Chuck Schumer, when he tries to do TikTok or Instagram, it just falls so flat. I mean, plenty of Republicans are uninteresting as well, I will concede. But I think the Democrats are trying this too much as a big business approach to doing politics when they don't understand the game of politics has changed.
I have to agree with you. You know, I was going to say before that, that part of what's handicapping Democrats is they don't have a majority in either of the houses. So they don't have kind of the natural platform that comes with that power. But you're right. There have been plenty of instances where Republicans commanded the attention and got people's attention and got the headlines and got the news and got people talking about their positions for better or worse when they were not in power in the House or not in power in the Senate or not even in the White House. And yet people were paying attention. And it's unfortunate, we have to say, they have to be better entertainers. It's not exactly entertainment. It's you have to be captivated.
So let's just say entertainment is important and Trump is, you know, joyous in some way, okay. Right? People like to go to his rallies and hear him. But it took two issues that we are going to talk about today. One is the remodeling of the White House or the demolition of the East Wing, right? I mean, again, the Democrats' issue is historical preservation and transparency and corruption. I mean, all important and all I'm in favor of, right? And I think – but what Trump is saying is let's do something. Let's be bold. Let's make the building, you know, fun and interesting and have parties. And it's not a terrible idea. And if other people were doing it, I think you'd just see the reverse. I mean, I don't think the idea itself is a bad idea. I may not like his architectural style. I may not like the way he's going to do it. I don't like the way he goes about doing it. But he gets things done. And I think people like that. The same with what's happening in the Middle East. I mean, give the man some credit. He busted that thing up and put pressure on the sides. And he is going to. It looks like, you know, who knows what will happen, but he has made a huge progress. And I think there's a kind of willingness to do unconventional, disruptive things that he has that people like. And it's a very American idea. We've become the party of the don't build this because it's going to do that, or don't, you know, do this because it's going to interfere with some regulation or whatever. I think we have to understand that people want things to get done and want people who are going to go out and do things. I don't like the way Trump does them. I don't like what he does a lot of the time. But I think, you know, what Judy is saying is maybe you don't agree with this. I don't know. But I think Democrats have to be more fun, more willing to take risks and more willing to not have everything be, you know, not offend anybody because we're afraid of offending any group. you have to go do things and you have to speak your mind. And I think Trump does that. And people actually, until the Democrats find someone who's able to speak their minds and articulate a strong vision of leadership, I think it's going to be very hard to recapture the minds of the American people.
Somebody should be able to articulate why the tearing down the East Wing of the White House is something you should care about.
Why? Why? I mean, look, it was only built in 1942.
I'm not making the argument as to why you shouldn't do it. I'm saying you make the argument. You need to find the way to make the argument in a way that Trump would make the argument. So let's assume that Joe Biden tore down the White
picture.
House. How would he do it?
But again, well, hold on for a second. Again, I'm listening to
what
you're
arguing. We've now moved on to another topic.
But what we're arguing about, to me, it's we shouldn't be putting any public money into a ballroom when we don't have a control over inflation, we don't have a control over prices, that the economy is crap right now, and that there's no consumer confidence. That's what we should be talking about, okay?
And that's
not the historical value of the bricks that are there.
But then he says he's not putting public money in it, and then people say, oh, well, that's a problem because there's no transparency and it leads to corruption.
And you know something? He can say anything he wants. We know there's public money that's going into it. And that's the position, is that that given everything that's going on, this is a ridiculous use of your tax dollars when your kids may be going hungry.
Photos of construction teams knocking down parts of the East Wing, first revealed by the Washington Post on Monday, shocked preservationists, raised questions about White House overreach and lack of transparency, and sparked complaints from Democrats that President Donald Trump was damaging, quote, the people's house to pursue a personal priority. The demolition job began Monday with the disappearance of the White House's eastern entrance. It advanced Tuesday with the destruction of much of the East Wing, according to a photograph obtained by the Washington Post and two people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the scene. Although, from what I can tell, you could pretty much see it from the street. But
yeah.
They're wrecking it, said Martha Joint Kumar, a political scientist and professor emeritus at Towson University in Maryland, and these are changes that cannot be undone. They're destroying that history forever. A White House spokesman said the entirety of the East Wing would eventually be, quote, modernized and rebuilt. The National Trust for Historic Preservation, a nonprofit created by Congress to help preserve historic buildings, sent a letter Tuesday to administration officials warning that the planned 90,000 square foot ballroom will overwhelm the White House itself, which is about 55,000 square feet. We respectfully urge the administration, but see, to all your points, not as fun.
No, and you don't call it, you don't attack it as a personal priority. You attack it as an extravagant vanity project or something. You find a violation of, I think the People's House is starting to get there, but, you know, there is a way to raise the outrage factor on this. Is what you want to do when you're trying to make a political argument.
You know, Stephen Colbert, the comedian, said that there's no way Donald Trump's going to get a security deposit back.
Yeah. Yes,
that's fun.
Absolutely.
Which is brilliant.
That's fun. Yes. The National Trust for Historic Preservation, a nonprofit created by by Congress to help preserve historic buildings, sent a letter. I read that already. I apologize. We respectfully urge the administration and the National Park Service to pause demolition until plans for the proposed ballroom go through the legally required public review processes. They tore the damn thing down. I don't know how much you're going to go back on it now.
Well, even the respectfully urge. You know, if Elise Stefanik wrote that letter, it would have been, I demand.
Yes. No, that's true. White House officials dismissed the criticism as manufactured outrage, arguing that, why can't outrage be, like, it can be real outrage, right? It doesn't have to be manufactured.
No.
Arguing that past presidents had pursued their own changes to an executive campus as necessary. You know, things like changing a closet or taking out a bowling alley. Solar panels on top of the White House. Yes.
There is a way in which it's manufactured, because if Biden had done this or a next Democratic president had done this, people would say, oh, this is an important, you know, renovation and we need to update the White House. I mean, I just think this is one of those things where, you know, he's doing
it. I
don't
know if I buy that. I think if any president that picture is seen, you're going to have a reaction to it. And if it's done in a way that has gone through the proper channels, less so. But when you say, but when you start seeing a big claw come in, as if it's going after Beanie Babies in a in a vending machine, yeah, and just grabbing pieces of this building, I don't know. I think no matter who does it, I don't think if Biden did this, I think there would have been just as much outrage.
I mean, think of the aggregate. He's got this garden of statues he's going to build. Remember, there's 100 statues he's going to put up of American heroes. He wants to build an arch. He redid the Rose Garden. And so it's the aggregate nature, I think, that Democrats should focus on, the fact that these are all vanity projects. And it's one thing to put a swimming pool in, I think, or cover it
Reagan
up.
Reagan did the swimming pool, didn't he?
Yeah, and then one of them covered it up. I know is that the Lego people are going to have to come up with a new edition of their White House architectural
absolutely
kit.
Yeah, well, they're going to have to double the size.
I mean, what bothers me is that the thing is going to be double the size of the White House. I mean, it's a complete. I mean, it's his style of bombast and architecturally not interesting, but that's not going to win arguments. I mean, the East Wing was built in 1942. Yeah, there's history behind it, but I don't think it's the people's house. And I think that we have to, you know, I do think it is manufactured. I think that people would not be upset if it were being done in a way that they, by someone they liked, and in a way that they, you know, with a nicer ballroom when they liked.
Well, it was nicer too. I mean, Donald Trump himself, if he were not Donald Trump and doing this, he would call it a disgusting, illegal destruction of the White House. That's what he would call it.
Well, I look forward to the day when we can tear it down and put the Rose Garden back. And actually, it would be very, very symbolic of a country returning itself more to its roots from this.
You bring up, and we're up against the break, but you bring up a really good point, because one of the things when I heard about the Rose Garden, I got very upset, and there were some archivists on restoration architects who said, well, I mean, that can be brought back to what it was. That can always be brought back to what it was. This project is less so, obviously. Yeah. And I think that's what's concerning.
I think that same thing as ripping down the wing can rip down this abomination, too.
We'll take a break, and we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll finish up on the other side of a BBC news break. panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, and we will be right back after this.
If there was a stranger in the middle,
good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A reminder, the music you're hearing is of Ruthie Foster playing Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs tomorrow night. And you can see the playlist at WAMC.org/playlist. WAMC.org/roundtable, and then look for the playlist. That's how you find it. Good morning, all. We are going to wrap up here with a lightning round. A lot to talk about in a few minutes, so we'll run through these topics at a pretty good pace, I think, this morning, and figure out maybe try to make sense of other things in the world, because we're doing such a good job otherwise. I don't know. I think we had a good discussion this morning, but Jay brought up a very good point during the break. Do you want to share that point?
Well, it was just that we talked about really the two kind of more hot button issues or the more incendiary issues, but we had other issues on our list, and it just wasn't a complaint to you, Joe, by any means.
No.
But your leadership is in question now. No. But we didn't talk about some of the more consequential things that we did plan to talk about, which were, among other things, a war that is not unending in Ukraine and unending thanks to a president who doesn't seem to be able to focus on anything.
Okay, so now we're going to try to make up for that. So first we will begin with the back and forth. We talked a lot about Russia yesterday. We had Alexander Mihailovich and other our wonderful panelists who addressed this in really interesting ways. But one of the things that there was some assessment that there would be a meeting between Trump and Putin. Now, in a reversal, Trump will not meet with Putin in coming weeks. The back and forth was the latest example of President Trump teasing breakthrough, only to be pulled back by President Putin of Russia. The announcement punctuated the rosy picture that Mr. Trump had presented just 5 days ago after he spoke on the telephone with Mr. Putin and came away with a plan for a pretty quick in-person meeting in Budapest to discuss ending the war. The White House reversed itself on Tuesday and said that President Trump no longer planned to meet with Putin in the immediate future, after Russian officials made clear they had no intention of making a deal to end the war in Ukraine. "I don't want to have a wasted meeting," Mr. Trump said on Tuesday and asked why the meeting was put off. When asked why the meeting was put off, "I don't want to have a wasted time, so I'll see what happens."
And you know, this is a president who keeps avoiding, you know, really, really taking a clear position on Russia. He teases things. He plays with it. I don't think there's anything brilliant about this strategy. I think it's the same thing that we, you know, he has done in all the other foreign policy situations he has found himself in, which is I call it the spaghetti approach. It's just keep throwing things against the wall and see what sticks. I don't know if Putin is playing him, or he is just playing a game with Putin to draw this war out as long as possible and just let Putin win this by attrition. But the idea that, you know, everyone should just go home, as he put it the other day, that they should just stop where they are and go home and stop killing people, that's basically saying let Putin keep everything he seized, and that's the end of it. That's no solution. He should give them the tomahawks. He should let them ramp it up. But if he doesn't, it looks like Europe is gonna up the ante if he won't.
Judy,
This is a minor detail, but because there's so much going on when Donald Trump talks about anything, but he mistakenly refers to the Obama administration controlling the start of the war when he means the Biden administration. He does it repeatedly. He does the same thing when he's talking about the extension of the Obamacare tax credits. He refers to it happening under Obama instead of Biden. So that's just a small point. You know, let's remember that he came away from Alaska, the Alaskan summit, thinking there was going to be some sort of trilateral. He likes to use bilateral, trilateral, a meeting between Zelensky, Putin, and himself. That didn't happen. Within 2 weeks, it didn't happen. He came away from the telephone conversation with Putin last week, I think, saying that there was going to meeting. He seems naive about this, and he does seem like he's getting played. It may be some sort of upper level chess game that I'm not getting, but the bottom line is Zelensky came out this morning and said he's okay with the ceasefire at the lines where everything is right now. That seems like an important concession or an important compromise in this protracted war. But Putin just wants to keep going. He has no intention of stopping this war until he gets what he wants.
Bob?
I don't think he can stop right now. I think there's enough issues at home for Putin that if he stopped, that he would have to watch out for his own safety. I think we're getting played. I also think that there are variables that we as the population are not aware of that has more to do with oligarchs talking to oligarchs about protecting oligarchs, which is playing a role in the whole geopolitical issue of what's going on there. So I think there's some major shifts that are going on, because I think there are some forces at play here that have more to do with personal money and assets than any time we've seen, probably since, you know, World War One, even, you know, sort of that pre-World War One period.
Roger?
So my sympathies are with Ukraine and Ukrainians. I think the war that Putin has started, starting back with Crimea, back all the way back, has been a disaster. And I don't think the world has done much to stop it. Biden did a little, but was largely keeping the war going. And I think you have to give Trump some credit, right? As Judy said, he's gotten Zelensky to sort of say what would be needed to stop the war from the Ukrainian side. But most importantly, he's gotten Europe engaged. And Europe is now understands the threat that Russia poses. I think it's a real threat. And Europe is beginning to arm themselves and think about how to support Ukraine in a much more meaningful way. And, you know, we tend not to ever want to give the president credit for things he's done, whether he deserves the credit or not. But he, in this case, I think he does deserve some of it. And I think that the engagement of Europe, which is now accepting and arguing that we should have a peace on the at the current where the battle lines are, and getting Europe and Zelensky on that ground, and Europe now rearming, I think has been a huge positive for what he's done, and I at least think we should recognize that.
I think anything that Europe is doing is a failure of Donald Trump's leadership, his failure to lead at all in this case, and his scattershot approach to this has left Europe saying, we got to do something ourselves. I don't think you give a guy credit for being incompetent.
So Zelensky, but also let's be a little more open-eyed about Zelensky too. This is winter. It's coming into the winter season. So if he could lock down where things are right now and get a security guarantee from both the Europeans and the United States that would protect his airspace, that's a good deal for him, because they're not going to, you know, winter offenses are traditionally really, really difficult and consuming in both material and manpower.
And Ukraine is developing some very effective long-range drones and missiles that are probably maybe even better than what we have in some circumstances. And, I think we'll be able to put a huge amount of hurt on Russia's economy and oil production in the next 6 months. Now, by the way, Russia's doing that to Ukraine as well. So Ukraine is suffering immensely, and we should not forget that. I think that who knows what's going to happen in the next 6 months.
All right, let's move on to another issue and continue our conversation. Why do I keep my apologies here for my my internet issues, which are becoming more and more annoying. So my apologies. Let's go to this story, which is you see this, Jay? It's just like gray. It's like my computer is redacting what I'm trying to read. It's a redaction. It's just like a lot
Did
of
you
lines.
Travel out of the country recently,
no,
John?
No, I don't know what happened. I've been schnookered.
It's a buffering problem or internet problem.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Put more quarters in the machine, Joe.
Right?
So where did you want to go next?
Well, that's what I'm trying to remember. What was the other story?
Well, we could talk about the new House member, or we could talk about
I want to talk about the new House member, because we haven't talked about that. Now, we only have like 2 or 3 minutes because I can't get my damn machine working. But what is this is a fascinating case out of Arizona. And they have an election. This woman wins the election, and then all they have to do is
swear her in.
Yep. Find a Bible, and I don't know. We didn't even do that for the president, so who knows? But we have to find a Bible, swear her in, and we're all set. This is an issue. This has become an issue, and it is something that Speaker Johnson is refusing to do, mm-hmm. and. The question is, and I think we know why, but the question is why.
And in case Speaker Johnson forgot, he promised. Well, he didn't promise because, again, there was no Bible involved. But he said 2 weeks ago that he would swear her in on Monday or Tuesday. I wrote and the reason I know that is because we wrote an editorial about this. And I said, and my editor said, well, that's on the page for Tuesday. And I said, by Tuesday, it may be moot. Maybe he's going to swear her in. She goes, well, then we'll celebrate that. Sure enough, Tuesday came, the whole week came, still not sworn in, and a week went by, another week went by, and here we are. I did not fully put stock in the Epstein controversy until this.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to think that this is the that this is all about the Epstein thing, and he is just stalling for time, and I don't know how long he can stall. Maybe they're just hoping they can turn a few Republicans back.
That's I mean that's the thing is just how long is it. I mean, eventually you have to, right?
Right.
I mean, it's not.
But don't you think that's the whole Santos thing too? Is that he threw the Santos commutation out to throw a bone to Marjorie Taylor Greene? I mean, it's all about the Epstein files. She's the vote. She is the vote that will put enough House votes in to force the Speaker to act on it.
Yeah.
Also, don't believe the crap coming out of the Speaker's mouth about the Pelosi precedent. When Pelosi, it was a 25-day period for her to swear in a new member of Congress. That was at the request of that House member. So this isn't a precedent. You know, he's trying to say that this is a precedent. It's not a precedent.
Look, this is just everyone doing what Trump tells them to do. I mean, these people have lost any independence, any sense of obligation. And it's a travesty that we're living in a country in which basically one man controls all the branches of government.
We're out of time. My thanks to everyone for being with us. I appreciate it. Apologize for my computer problems, and they will be rectified hopefully very soon. Thank you all. We'll be right back.